books and accessible reading on RNIB Connect Radio. For everyone who loves books, this is Read On, the audiobook show on RNIB Connect Radio.
Hello and welcome to Read On, the audiobook show made in association with RNIB Talking Books. I'm your host, Robert Kirkwood, and on today's show, blind BBC presenter, content creator, disability activist, and face of Pan 10, Lucy Edwards, tells me about her books, Blind Not Broken, and her brand new children's book, Ella Jones vs. the Sun Stealer. Plus, we'll find some brand new audiobooks that have also made their way into the RNIB Talking Books Library. That's all coming up on today's Read On. Lucy Edwards is an award-winning blind presenter, content creator and disability activist, who's usually accompanied by her guide dog, Miss Molly. Her new book, Ella Jones vs. the Sun Stealer, is narrated by Sarah Ovens.
The man hears the ancient chest in the cave shake before he sees it. The rattling sound of the heavy chain that has held it closed for centuries echoes off the walls. He spins round to watch the golden glow trapped within the chest escape through the cracks of the lid, filling the dark cave with a dim, wobbling light. A wicked grin breaks across his face.
Sarah Ovens reading from Ella Jones vs. the Sun Stealer by my guest, Lucy Edwards. Now, we've got a few things to talk about, your book, your role as an RNIB ambassador. But if you don't mind, could I start by asking you about your eye condition?
Yes, of course. So I have a really rare genetic condition called incontinenti pigmenti. A bit of a mouthful, I just say IP for short. It runs down the female line of my genes. Although my late grandma nor my mom is blind, it actually presented itself when I was 4 years old as a skin condition on the backs of my legs. It looked a bit like chicken pox, and my mom and dad were really worried, and I got it diagnosed as IP when I was younger, and then it went away and I went for a routine eye check at age 8, and I always say the rest is history, really. They rushed me to the eye hospital and my mom and dad were really, really shocked. So today, as it stands, I am a total. That's what I say, very jovially. I don't mind being blind. I love it, in fact, but it's taken me a long time to get here. I lost my eyesight in my right eye at age 11 through IP and a retinal detachment, and left eye at 17. So yeah, I'm 29 now and I only have occasional days where I can see a bit of light. But yeah, that's me.
This year we're celebrating 200 years of Braille. Did you learn Braille at school?
I did, although I was that typical teenager, like, oh, I'm not blind. I'm never going to be blind. That's what I used to say to my teachers. And they're like, well, you never know. You know, it's a good skill to have. You're visually impaired, you know. And I used to say to my teacher, oh, I just really don't want to do it. But at 15, I did actually learn the alphabet because I was really lucky, actually. I had a visual impairment unit on the side, like plopped on the side of my state school. So there were a lot of different positive influences of blindness around me. And my teacher even had a guide dog, which then kind of prompted me to be like, oh, guide dogs are cute. So yeah, that's when I started. But I think properly, I was about 17 when I first lost my eyesight. And then that's when I was fully into feeling different grains of rice. And is this quinoa? Is this long grain? Is this short grain? And being quite frustrated. But I love Braille. I don't know what I'd do without it. I use it all the time. It's all over everything in my house, in my pantry, you know, in my wardrobe. So yeah, I don't know what I'd do without it.
Now, there's a myth that I've heard so many times that losing one sense enhances the others. Can you confirm or deny that losing your sight has turned you into Daredevil?
I love this. It's such a stereotype. So for me, because I had mobility lessons from the age of 11 with an instructor that obviously taught me how to hone my senses, I always say my senses didn't get better. I didn't suddenly grow an extra ear when I lost my vision. What happened was I just learned how to use them in a different way than I guess the quote unquote typical way. So yeah, I did learn how to hone into different sounds around me. I can't hear, unfortunately, a pin drop from up the road, although I wish that was the case. But yeah, that's what how I always describe it. They're not a lot better than they were.
After straightening his tie and adjusting the cuffs of his tailored jacket, he casually steps over the woman lying unconscious on the ground. He's careful not to tread on her outstretched hand. Glancing down, he sees the intricate sun tattoo on her wrist and sighs heavily. She was a necessary casualty. She would have tried to stop him. The chest is shaking more violently now. As the man cautiously approaches it, he can hear the links of the chain creak and groan as they strain against the force trying to break them apart. Suddenly, the chain breaks, clattering as it falls, its hefty padlock hitting the ground with a loud clunk. The man stops, his eyes widening abruptly, his breath catching. A small oval shape carved into the lid of the chest has begun to glow violet. The cave is momentarily bathed in a radiant purple before the oval stone shakes itself loose and falls, skittering across the ground towards the cave wall. With its light knocked out, it looks like any other grey pebble that you might find on a beach somewhere, smooth and small and dark, one of many such pebbles, all insignificant. The man has forgotten about it already, his attention solely on the chest, which now sits completely still in the corner. It has stopped shaking.
Now, your character, Ella Jones, might not have superpowers, but she is indeed trying to save the world.
Yes, and it was really important to me with my children's book for Ella Jones not to be a superhero because of the trope of Daredevil. I adore Daredevil as a story, but I get a lot of comments on social media about, I guess, that stereotype. And through no fault of anyone's own, they haven't had any other proper, authentic representations of blindness in the media. So people don't necessarily know any better when they're commenting that. But I wanted to create Ella as a really positive force to be reckoned with, really. Yes, she's saving the world. Yes, the world around her is the kind of supernatural thing in a way, but herself, she's just an amazing, conscientious, authentic representation of blindness. She's so amazing, and she lost her eyesight only a few years earlier. She saves the world with her best friend Finn and her sister Poppy and her guide dog Miss Maisie, very much based on Miss Molly, my guide dog. So yeah.
Now, is it the book you wished you could have read at that age?
Oh, absolutely. I used to dream of reading stories about blindness because when I actually lost my eyesight, I felt so sick and terrified. There was no one around me that was losing their vision, and I didn't see anyone. I wasn't represented in the media. So I thought, oh, well, now I've lost my eyesight. I'm 17. What do I do? I almost thought that I couldn't have any dreams, and I didn't. I went into depression because of that, because it's almost like society didn't have an expectation of me, so then I didn't have an expectation of myself to amount to anything, and that for me is so sad. And when I wake up every morning, I think of my why, and I think, people who are losing their eyesight now, kids, older adults, they need to see themselves represented. And I love that Ella's out in the world. It makes me so emotional that if I talk about it for too long, I'll probably cry because it just means so much to me. And I know that my younger self is like cheering right now.
Now, well, at the risk of making you emotional, tell us what Ella is trying to save the world from. Give us a taste of the book.
Yeah, so she is saving the world from a god of old who stole the light from humanity. So he. There's a lot of things going on, but basically she has to find a way to get the light back, and there's loads of different things in her way. She has to go to a mythos library and find different artifacts that are really in the history of this god of old that really intertwine into an amazing adventure story. And there's different landmarks within London, where all of these different MacGuffins, I guess, are hidden, and she has to fight different things within each location with the Book of Incense, which this Book of Incense is very. It smells, but it's also full of braille. But there's some historical accuracy to a few things in the book as well. And this is how we've kind of made the adventure quite wide-reaching. But there's my favourite part of it is when they're in London Zoo, and there's a moment with Guide Dog Miss Maisie, which I loved writing with Katie, my co-author. It was brilliant. So yeah.
All is silent. The man waits, his breathing heavy and uneven. "Come on," he whispers desperately, staring at it. "Come on." As though on cue, the lid falls back with an ear-splitting creak. A shimmering gold light bursts out and fills the room, so bright that the man yelps and shields his eyes. When it dims enough for him to lower his arm, he squints at the figure emerging now from the chest. He sees the white tunic that is torn and frayed, the long blonde hair tamed into a plait down the figure's back, the fair beard unkempt and knotted. He is aware of the frame inside the tunic, too tall, too broad for this to be human, despite its man-like form. A large glass pendant hangs round the apparition's neck, swaying on a gold chain, glinting when it catches the light.
Now, the book takes you all over London, but you yourself, you've travelled all over the world. How does the UK measure up to other places in terms of accessible travel? And have you experienced something in another country that we definitely should have here?
Rob, oh my gosh, Japan is everything. When I filmed with the BBC, that documentary in Japan, I remember just walking out onto the street and the tactile lines there were out of this world. There was like little junction boxes. You could go left or right and really have the autonomy. I think back to London and going to Moorfields Eye Hospital, my stomping ground for years and years and years. And there is a line outside of Moorfields to go to the tube, and it's very much trodden down now. You can't really feel it with your cane. So it's learning from Japan, I guess, that we can use different materials there. Even there was tactile lines onto the ferry when I was going across the to Sado Island. And also, you go into Shinkansens, which are the bullet trains, and into the toilet, and you've got a tactile map of the toilet layout, which is, side note, very, very clean. So I really appreciated all of that. I didn't need to get my Dettol wipes out and yeah, understand where I was, which is just so lovely.
For everyone who loves books, this is Read On, the audiobook show on RNIB Connect Radio.
We'll continue our chat with Lucy Edwards in a moment, but now let's take our first visit to the RNIB Talking Books Library to find some brand new books.
Thanks to the kind donations from many of UK's audio publishers, it can be hard to keep up with all the great new books entering the Talking Books Library. So here are two new gems. New in the library from Hodder is Irresponsible Adult by Lucy Dillon.
The first text appeared while I was showing the Peterson family around what the rest of the office had taken to calling the Doom Barn, and which I was currently calling a unique combination of rural tradition and ultra-modern comfort. It was certainly unique. Blackberry Barn was a hulking conversion that looked unnervingly like Darth Vader in photographs, no matter what angle we tried to take them from. It was huge. It was clad in dark Siberian larch, and it was hard to make a positive of the original owner's decision to build the conservatory around a stone cider press the size of a small car instead of removing it. But if anyone could shift this unfortunately located, overpriced aircraft hangar of a home, it was me.
Sisters Cleo and Robin may be close in age, but their attitudes to life could not be further apart. While Chloe's a fully fledged adult with a family, a business, and a signature scent, Robin is still waiting for the instruction manual to adult life, and success is keeping her houseplant alive. Skating by at her job as an estate agent, she's adept at avoiding housework, ignoring admin, and evading her mother's anxious questions about her love life. But then Robin's fired in the most publicly humiliating way imaginable, and her chaos catches up with her. Although Cleo steps in to give Robin a temporary job in her cleaning firm, it comes with very firm instructions. Robin must behave responsibly. And that includes meeting the high standards of Jim, her enigmatic supervisor. But when Robin learns to navigate the catastrophic kitchens and judgmental dogs of total strangers, she learns some unexpected truths about her own messy world. Not everybody's life is spotless. Is it time, finally, for everyone to stop sweeping their secrets under the carpet?
So far, the viewing had been going to plan. I'd started in the impressive kitchen diner, which ran almost the full length of the barn, and their reactions had been as I'd anticipated. Steve Peterson had nodded thoughtfully at the concealed appliances, while his wife Catherine warmed to the clinical smoothness of everything, once I'd mentioned how easy it was to clean. I was reeling off the mod cons when I was interrupted by the message alert. "Robin, we need to talk. No name, no recognisable number." I swallowed as my brain flipped hurriedly through several possibilities. Had Diana, the office manager, opened my secret filing drawer, the one where my paperwork was concealed for urgent sorting? Or was it Cleo, complaining about the state of a client's house? Some of the end-of-tenancy cleaning jobs I put her way were a bit hard-going. But she had her own ringtone alert on my phone, and she never texted me when she could call and yell directly into my ear. Or was it Johnny, from the office, trying to put me off my stride? That was more likely. Our manager, Dean, was offering a prize for the first person to get an offer on the table for the Doom Barn. As the Petersons inspected the soft-closed triple oven, my guilty conscience slid sideways to a couple of long shots. Tyler, the conveyancer I'd had a few dinners with, then ghosted several months ago? Or Doug, ditto, but antique dealer? I wasn't great at breakups. Another text followed. "How about tomorrow night? I have exciting news on the architect." And then I knew exactly who it was, and my heart corrected its anxious plunge and swooped upwards like a fairground swingboat. It was Mitch Maitland, calling about the secret project.
Irresponsible Adult by Lucy Dillon is narrated by Karen Cass and runs for 12 hours and 22 minutes.
We have Three Perfect Liars by Heidi Parks, which was given to us by Penguin Random House.
It had taken 7 minutes for the first of the fire engines to screech to a halt outside the offices of Morrison Wood. But even by then, anyone could have seen it was too late. The fire had coursed through the building at an alarming rate. Red and orange flames were already obscured by a billowing cloud of dark grey smoke. The sound of breaking glass shattered the air. She was on the quay across the river from the office with a perfect view that she no longer wanted, yet couldn't bring herself to turn away from. To her right, a few people had spilled out of the Star pub and the couple of restaurants nearby. It was a warm evening in mid-May, warm enough to be out enjoying the longer evening, even though it was a Monday night. Most of the onlookers had probably protested against the development of the Morrison Wood offices when plans for the building were first proposed to the council. The development had caused outrage 5 years ago. Ad hoc meetings set up in cafes and school halls had been attended by angry residents from Lymington and beyond, who refused to allow such an eyesore to be built.
When Laura returns from maternity leave to work in a marketing agency, something isn't right. Mia was only supposed to be temporary cover for Laura, but now she's staying permanently. Struggling with the burdens of work and motherhood, Laura starts to feel her life is slipping away. Then comes the fire gutting the agency's offices and the body pulled out of the wreckage. The police want to talk to three women. There's Janie, utterly devoted wife to the CEO. There's Mia, the agency's bright new talent, and there's Laura, a loyal employee of many years. Their lives might look perfect from the outside, but their secrets won't stay hidden forever.
No one, they had said, wants to look across the Lymington River from the beautiful quay and see a monstrosity of a glass office staring back at them. Bloody Londoners, they had murmured among themselves. They are the problem, coming to the south coast from the city, taking over our town. Only a few months later, Harry Wood had had them all eating out of his palm. Well, maybe not all of them, but the ones who counted. And so the plans had been approved. The building work started. Anyone who knew the first thing about architecture should have been able to see the offices would be a thing of beauty. Too much so for an advertising agency, perhaps. By then, the same residents had begun to forgive Harry Wood for anything. He had recruited locally, was supporting charities close to their hearts. The Lymington Care Home had never had so many minibuses and outings to the New Forest. Yet once upon a time, some of the people now gawping at the fire, as it continued to ravage the building, might have joked to their friends that they'd have liked to have burned it to the ground themselves. Because even after it was built, when its tall glass front reflected the light from the water, dappled against the setting sun, it still left a bitter taste in the mouths of a few. The ones who saw through people like Harry Wood.
Three Perfect Liars by Heidi Perks is narrated by Sarah Poyser, Rupert Farley and Olivia Darnley and runs for 10 hours and 43 minutes.
RNIB Talking Books provides more than 1 million audiobooks every year to people with sight loss and is now completely free for all blind and partially sighted people in the UK. The RNIB Library is the largest of its kind in Europe and offers a wide range of fiction and non-fiction titles, which readers can access on CD, on USB, or as a digital download, so that you can listen how you choose, whether at home or on the go. To find out more about the RNIB Library or to sign up for your free membership, call the RNIB helpline on 0303 123 9999 or visit www.rnib.org.uk/library.
And now on Read On, we continue our chat with Lucy Edwards. Now, your book, Ella Jones versus Sun Stealer, is, of course, available in audio and braille from RNIB, also in audio commercially. But that's not your only involvement with the charity RNIB, as you've recently become an ambassador.
Yes, I'm so excited about that. Honestly, I think last year was very much a moment for me where I was advocating about the right to vote as a blind person, and that video did really well off the back of Tom coming to my house. Tom is a fabulous staff member at the RNIB that deals with the Electoral Commission and accessible voting. And, you know, we had a great chat about all of the different kit that's available to people. And I wanted to do that video in collaboration. And we put out that RNIB link to really get people to say, you know, what would be better when you vote and how do you vote now? And kind of that fact finding. And then I did a video on e-bikes and really advocating for the fact that we can't hear e-bikes and they're all over the road and the street clutter. And I think for me, those two campaigns really just drove my kind of appetite to want to really make that relationship kind of official. And I know that with Ella Jones versus the Sun Stealer, RNIB really being at the forefront of doing the braille copy and knowing that it was being announced, and then also the collaboration with amazing Betsy, who's 11 years old, who was in my launch video on my across my social media. Andrew at the social media team was just really, really great in getting that, you know, connection started. And, you know, I want to collaborate with more people within the community. And after doing this story, Ella Jones versus the Sun Stealer, I'm just like, well, let's collaborate with more young people and have their voices heard. And yeah, as you can see, I'm very excited.
Talking of travel with Miss Smalls, have you ever had a taxi refusal?
I have. Oh, it's mainly with Olga, actually, my first guide dog. It was a lot. I had to take a taxi driver to court. I was standing outside law school, and there was a few moments where either one drove off, which I took him to court, and then I have actually been spat at and sworn at in several different occasions with Olga. And then with Miss Moles, it's mainly refusals to restaurants these days. I went to a sushi restaurant, naming no names, but I was very distressed when they refused us there. So it's just constant, really. It's awful, isn't it? Because it's almost like you change your behaviours in order to kind of not have that happen. And I find myself doing that all the time to avoid the conflict, which you shouldn't have to do. But yeah, it's really lovely because for me, I just kind of just say, I bring Miss Molly to places where I'm having meetings in London. The train tends to be okay. And then once I'm in the meeting, people know that I'm obviously meeting them with a guide dog. So it's a lot better then. And then I try and go to chain restaurants really to try and combat that, which I haven't really had problems with in coffee shops. So yeah.
The eyes are mesmerizing, the colour of glowing gold, and the body is framed in a bright luminosity that seems to ripple, as though it is constantly battling against some force trying to suck it inside the being's skin. This is no human. This is a god.
"Oh!"
the man gasps. "The legend is true. It was all true."
Is it really you?"
he croaks, the wobble in his voice betraying his fear.
Narrator Sarah Ovens reading from Ella Jones versus the Sun Stealer. Did you have any choice in the narrator?
Yes, I did. Scholastic gave me several different narrators to choose from, and we were kind of talking about the speed and the tone, and it was really great because I don't know. I think I really connected with Sarah's voice. I think it's quite playful, but also very just perfect for the story. In the serious moment, she's serious, and she does the voice is amazing. I don't know if you've heard her voice for Finn. It's everything.
And of course, narration is something you've got experience in because you narrated your first book, Blind Not Broken. How was that?
I didn't know how I was going to do that initially, but they actually, Octopus actually hired an actor who was my publisher for that book to basically talk at a certain beat per minute. And then it was in my headphones, and I wore like my AirPods underneath the big studio headphones. And I just spoke and spoke and spoke. And then I had my producer on the other end, and he just said, "Oh, go back, do that again." And I felt like a cyborg at some moments, but also you have to kind of rev your brain to kind of go into a different mode of like listening and then speaking and then talking all simultaneously. It was quite a challenge, but I really enjoyed doing that.
Blind Not Broken, written and read by Lucy Edwards. The last room I ever saw was the inpatient ward at Moorfields Eye Hospital. On 23rd of March 2013 at 8 a.m, I was sitting in my hospital gown and very glamorous knee-high bright white hospital socks. An arrow was drawn just above my left eyebrow in marker pen, pointing down to be sure the correct eye would be operated on. I didn't want to believe I was losing my eyesight, but as the hours ticked by, I longed for my name to be called to head into the operating theatre. I wished with every atom of my being that I could be on that plane with my friends right now. They were off on a History A level trip to Poland that I should have been on. I unlocked my iPhone and scrolled to my Spotify playlist called By Eye. Shaking, I plugged in my headphones and listened to Echo by songwriters Jason Walker and Nicole Ann Gallion. To this day, I find it hard to listen to that song without thinking about what happened. I remember repeating the lyrics, "I don't really know where the world is, but I miss it now." I felt numb and in a trance.
That was so important to be in my voice because it was very much, you know, about my story. But for this, I loved working with a voiceover artist because it's a children's book that has so many different voices. I just thought, oh, a professional at this kind of thing is just insane.
Now, the subtitle to Blind Not Broken is Your Guide to Turning Loss and Grief into Happiness.
Yeah, it's basically my journey of going blind. I have a very poignant moment in there where I actually fall off my bike, and that's the first time that I found out that I didn't have any light perception, and I was only 10, 11 years old. I was just on a bike ride with my family, all the way up to, you know, being the face of Pantene and working for different brands. So it's something that I feel really emotional that I've written, and I was able to write my thoughts and in a memoir slash guide. And I think the guide there really does, it just gives some practical tips on how I got through those moments mentally. I think ultimately I felt so emotional writing that book in a different way to my children's book, because it's such a different kind of frame of reference for me. Like, this children's book story has been in my mind for years and years and years. And when we think about Blind Not Broken, it was just such a different like mode to have my brain in. But I'm so glad that I'm able to bring both books into the world, because I think they serve different purposes. You know, if I am very emotional, and there's so many things that I've never said to the world within Blind Not Broken on how I felt and how blindness just really... So I guess the more negative sides of blindness, that now when writing Ella, I wish that I was as confident as Ella at her age. You know, being 12 years old and knowing everything that she does, she's got a big head on those little shoulders because of the knowledge and the processes that I've had to go through. You know, everything that I wish that I would have been and known is within Ella. You know, she's so confident, and she knows how to save the world. And obviously the world being plunged into darkness, that's her kind of way to say, you know, don't worry guys, like, I can do this. It's not scary. It's not the end of the world, even though you feel like it's the end of the world. And it was a really great way through that storyline to get that positivity and that confidence through blindness that I feel like I never had. I felt, when I first went blind, which you'll see in Blind Not Broken, I was very, very, like, I had so much internalised ableism, so.
Now, one thing we'll miss if we download the audio or get the Braille version from RNIB of Ella Jones versus the Sun Stealer is the cover. Can you give us a little description of it?
The cover. We had two dots who are the illustrators. It looks so epic and filmic. So it's gold. And on the front cover is very Ella in a very powerful stance. And she's got ginger hair like me. And she's standing there in her jeans next to Miss Maisie, her guide dog. And there's a fireball behind Miss Maisie. I mean, if I saw a fireball on a children's book when I was losing my eyesight, I would have felt so much more confident to be me. And I'm just hoping, like, that very powerful stance that Ella holds, and the fact that on the front cover as well, we've also got Braille and we've got Navilens. So we see Ella Jones versus the Sun Stealer and Braille, even on the cited copy. I think that's just a way to be like, Braille can also not only be something that, you know, blind people read, it's something that just lives within our society and should be made kind of normalised. And yeah, as I say, the more you scan the Navilens code, there's loads of different gorgeous illustrations inside the cover. And we really thought about how to audio describe it in that way. And I think for me as well, people ask me, like, why is there a Navilens code on the front cover of the book that for quote unquote sighted people? And I say, you know, as a blind person, I want to be able to find the book for the sighted people in my life, because that Navilens code does triangulate the audio, so you can find triangulate the positioning rather of the audio, so you can find the book in the shop.
The god steps out of the chest, straightening to his full height as his bare feet find the ground. He towers over the man, who gulps nervously, suddenly feeling very small and powerless. That is not a feeling this man is used to. He doesn't like it very much. He clears his throat, searching for his courage.
Lu, god of sun, light, and justice, the man calls out in a voice as loud as he can muster. Welcome back to the world. Lu peers down at him. Intimidated by the god's soul-piercing gaze, the man has to turn his face away. He cannot look at him directly, but watches Lu out of the corner of his eye. He sees, from this angle, that Lu has not one face, but three blending into one. The man shudders, fighting an instinct to cower in Lu's presence and reminding himself that he knew all this about the god. The hours he spent researching the legend have prepared him for the appearance of this mighty being.
Lucy Edwards, thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
And we'll have Lucy's Books of Your Life at the end of today's show. But for now, let's take our second trip to the RNIB library.
Hodder recently gave us The Chamber by Will Dean.
I leave Aberdeen behind and step up onto the gangplank of the Deep Topaz, our DSV or diving support vessel. I have already said my goodbyes. Salt breeze in my eyes, wind stinging. I climb on board with my bag. Mike Elliott is waiting for me, sun illuminating his weathered face and green eyes, picking out the silver in his eyebrows.
So foul and fair a day I have not seen.
His San Diego accent has been softened by a decade of North Sea life. Dickens?
The other guy. How's life?
Same ship, different day. He smiles, and I catch sight of the military tattoos on his forearms, some of them undisturbed, others camouflaged by fresh ink. Regrets and mistakes. Reinvention. I pull out my camcorder, and he makes his excuses and leaves me alone. I aim it awkwardly at myself, the flip-out screen displaying my pale, pointy face. No makeup or hairstyling, home-dyed hair almost too short for a ponytail. My mother used to call me pretty if you make a real big effort, and she was being generous.
On a boat heading out into the North Sea, Ellen Brooks steels herself to spend almost a month locked inside a hyperbaric chamber with five other divers. They're all being paid handsomely for this work, to be lowered each day inside a diving bell to the seabed, taking it in turns to dive down and repair oil pipes that lie in the dark waters. It's a close-knit team, and it has to be. Any error or loss of trust could be catastrophic. All is going to plan until one of the divers is found unresponsive in his bunk. He hadn't left the chamber. It will take four more days of decompression locked away together before the hatch can be opened. Four more days of bare steel, intrusive thoughts, and the constant struggle not to give way to panic. Mind games, exhaustion, suspicion, and most of all, pressure. And if someone doesn't lock the door, everybody dies.
This is our home for the next month, I say self-consciously. 28 of those days will be at pressure, or at depth, as we say. At least it will for Mike and me, and the other four saturation divers. We will live on board this ship in a small, pressurized chamber, and then we will descend in pairs via a diving bell to work shifts on the seabed. The pay is 5 or 10 times what we might earn onshore doing construction work. We are well compensated for the risk. I end the recording. The footage, which will be edited into a short film by one of the largest diving firms in Scotland, might help bring more women into the industry. I feel it's my duty to at least try. Deep inside the vessel, I discover Jumbo, a veteran sat diver from Liverpool. Some might call him my sat daddy, an experienced diver who once took me under his wing, although he and I have never used that term. Jumbo is short and dark and muscular, and he has the eyes of a much older man. His mother is Irish and his father is St. Lucian, and he is one of the most respected divers working British waters.
He is,
he says, his Scouse accent still strong despite living in Cawdor, east of Inverness, for decades.
Have your ears ready, Brooke?
I greet the medic, Gonzalez. Ellen Brooke? I nod, and she asks me to take a seat in the chair. We are probably the only two women on this ship. Long, curly, black hair and a serious, uneasy expression. She uses an otoscope to check my ears, because they are particularly vulnerable to changes in pressure. One thing Jumbo told me years ago, sat divers need guts and good ears.
The Chamber by Will Dean is narrated by Helen Keeley and runs for 9 hours and 18 minutes.
Another thriller recently added to the library is Lights Out by Louise Swanson, which was given to us by Hodder.
It's dark. Not just dark. It's like light never existed. Like it got gobbled up by a great, hulking, greedy monster. She's trapped in here with it, and it knows her deepest fear. It knows that bad things happen in the shadows. Children chanting outside in the place where it's bright. They forced her in here. They knew. They laughed and pointed and knew. Scaredy cat, scaredy cat, scaredy cat. She is. She hisses and pants and claws at the edges of her prison. A feral creature. Feels for walls, a door, the handle. Escape.
A state of emergency has been declared in the UK. From now on, at 8 p.m. every night, all electricity cuts out. The government promises it's a temporary measure. They promise they're always thinking of your safety. But for Grace, the darkness is anything but safe. Someone is coming into her house under its cover every night while she lies in bed upstairs, too terrified to sleep. Someone who knows her past, who knows why she has more reason to fear the dark than most. And every morning she wakes to a new message from the intruder. I have you in my sights. Love, the night. But how can Grace escape when there's nowhere safe left to hide?
Welcome to UK Gov, the best place to find government services and information. Lights Out announcement, 10th of December. A state of emergency has been declared concerning UK electricity. To ensure that we get through winter without major disruption, we must put in place a complete nighttime switch-off. It will begin on the 5th of January. Every night, between 8 p.m. and 7 a.m, energy supplies will be switched off by providers, except for those to essential services such as hospitals, hospices, care homes and supermarkets. Climate change and growing consumption have forced us to ensure that our supply chain does not break down. We have done this before. In 1974, a period of electricity rationing lasted for 2 months, with a 3-day working week. But we, as a country, came out stronger the other side. This year, as part of our Greater Green Plan, the one-day power-off scheme reduced energy consumption significantly. Lights Out will build on that success. This is a temporary measure and will prevent the need for a complete blackout. The government will continue to find ways of securing greener electricity supplies and will update you on a weekly basis. Further advice is available from your provider, from this government website, and from your local MP. Remember, the government's first priority is always the safety of our country. Households can prepare for this by reading our comprehensive leaflet, which will be sent to your mobile device tomorrow, or you can click here for more information.
Lights Out by Louise Swanson is narrated by Rose Robinson and runs for 12 hours and 55 minutes.
For more information, head to rniblibrary.com or call the helpline on 0303 123 9999.
Love books? Well, RNIB Library has a world of books and loads more reading for you to enjoy. And you can choose from Braille and talking books. For more info, head to rniblibrary.com or call our expert team on 0303 123 9999. RNIB Library, here for all your reading needs.
You're listening to Read On, the audiobook show with Robert Kirkwood.
And finally on today's show, a return to Lucy Edwards for The Books of My Life. So what's Was there a book from childhood that made you fall in love with reading?
Twilight. I don't know, that's probably such a typical, like, girl of my age moment, but I remember actually losing my eyesight when I was reading those books, but being so within the story that I was so sad when it was over. But yeah, Stephanie Meyer was amazing.
Twilight by Stephanie Meyer. My mother drove me to the airport with the windows rolled down. It was 75 degrees in Phoenix, the sky a perfect cloudless blue. I was wearing my favorite shirt, sleeveless white eyelet lace. I was wearing it as a farewell gesture. My carry-on item was a parka. In the Olympic Peninsula of Northwest Washington State, a small town named Forks exists under a near-constant cover of clouds. It rains on this inconsequential town more than any other place in the United States of America. It was from this town and its gloomy, omnipresent shade that my mother escaped with me when I was only a few months old. It was in this town that I'd been compelled to spend a month every summer until I was 14. That was the year I finally put my foot down. These past three summers, my dad, Charlie, vacationed with me in California for 2 weeks instead. It was to Forks that I now exiled myself, an action that I took with great horror. I detested Forks. I loved Phoenix. I loved the sun and the blistering heat. I loved the vigorous, sprawling city. "Bella," my mom said to me, the last of a thousand times before I got on the plane, "you don't have to do this." My mom looks like me, except with short hair and laugh lines. I felt a spasm of panic as I stared at her wide, childlike eyes. How could I leave my loving, erratic, harebrained mother to fend for herself? Of course she had Phil now, so the bills would probably get paid. There would be food in the refrigerator, gas in her car, and someone to call when she got lost. But still... "I want to go," I lied. I'd always been a bad liar, but I'd been saying this lie so frequently lately that it sounded almost convincing now. "Tell Charlie I said hi." "I will." "I'll see you soon," she insisted. "You can come home whenever you want. I'll come right back as soon as you need me." But I could see the sacrifice in her eyes behind the promise. "Don't worry about me," I urged. "It'll be great. I love you, Mom." She hugged me tightly for a minute, and then I got on the plane, and she was gone.
All of the books in the Twilight series by Stephanie Meyer are available in the RNIB Talking Books Library. Book 1, Twilight, is narrated by Jennifer Woodward. And is there a book on a rainy day you could happily curl up with and reread?
Yes. The Court of Thorns and Roses by Sarah J. Maas. It's a lot of fairies, and a lot of people my age are really into this, like, romantasy vibe. And it's, yeah, it follows this lovely girl who, yeah, is in this fairy world. It's amazing.
I had risked much in coming so far into the forest, but we'd finished our last loaf of bread yesterday and the remainder of our dried meat the day before. Still, I would have rather spent another night with a hungry belly than found myself satisfying the appetite of a wolf or a fairy. Not that there was much of me to feast on. I'd turned gangly by this time of year and could count a good number of my ribs. Moving as nimbly and quietly as I could between the trees, I pushed a hand against my hollow and aching stomach. I knew the expression that would be on my two elder sisters' faces when I returned to our cottage, empty-handed yet again. After a few minutes of careful searching, I crouched in a cluster of snow-heavy brambles. Through the thorns, I had a half-decent view of a clearing and a small brook flowing through it. A few holes in the ice suggested it was still frequently used. Hopefully something would come by. Hopefully. I sighed through my nose, digging the tip of my bow into the ground and leaned my forehead against the crude curve of wood. We wouldn't last another week without food. And too many families had already started begging for me to hope for handouts from the wealthier townsfolk. I'd witnessed firsthand exactly how far their charity went. I eased into a more comfortable position and calmed my breathing, straining to listen to the forest over the wind. The snow fell and fell, dancing and curling like sparkling spindrifts, the white fresh and clean against the brown and gray of the world. And despite myself, despite my numb limbs, I quieted that restless, vicious part of my mind to take in the snow-veiled woods. Once it had been second nature to savor the contrast of new grass against dark, tilled soil, or an amethyst brooch nestled in the folds of emerald silk. Once I dreamed and breathed and thought in color and light and shape. Sometimes I would even indulge in envisioning a day when my sisters were married and it was only me and father, with enough food to go around, enough money to buy some paint, and enough time to put those colors and shapes down on paper or canvas or the cottage walls. Not likely to happen anytime soon, perhaps ever. So I was left with moments like this, admiring the glint of pale winter light on snow. I couldn't remember the last time I'd done it, bothered to notice anything lovely or interesting. Stolen hours in a decrepit barn with Isaac Hale didn't count. Those times were hungry and empty and sometimes cruel, but never lovely. The howling wind calmed into a soft sighing. The snow fell lazily now, in big fat clumps that gathered along every nook and bump of the trees. Mesmerizing, the lethal, gentle beauty of the snow. I'd soon have to return to the muddy, frozen roads of the village, to the cramped heat of our cottage. Some small, fragmented part of me recoiled at the thought. Bushes rustled across the clearing. Drawing my bow was a matter of instinct. I peered through the thorns, and my breath caught. Less than 30 paces away stood a small doe, not yet too scrawny from winter, but desperate enough to wrench bark from a tree in the clearing. A deer like that could feed my family for a week or more. My mouth watered. Quiet as the wind hissing through dead leaves, I took aim.
A Court of Thorns and Roses by Sarah J. Maas is available commercially, as narrated by Jennifer Ikeda. And all four books in Sarah Maas's Throne of Glass series are available from RNIB Talking Books. And is there a book you've read recently? It doesn't have to be a contemporary book, but something you've read recently, it's fresh in the mind, you'd like to recommend.
So I am very much into like self-help books, and I've been listening to one about critical thinking, but I can't quite remember the name. Oh my God.
Ninja Edit.
It's Clear Thinking by Shane Parrish. I always listen to that when I'm running. I'm on chapter 16 and it makes me, to be honest, not think about running as many miles so I can get through like the mental barrier of running. But I'm loving that at the moment.
I started working at an intelligence agency in August 2001. A few weeks later, the world changed forever. Everyone at the agency suddenly found themselves thrust into positions and responsibilities they weren't ready for. My job involved constantly figuring out how to do things few had even imagined possible. Not only did I need to solve complicated new problems, but people's lives were at stake. Failure was not an option. One night, I was walking home at 3 a.m. after one of our operations. The outcome wasn't what I had hoped for. I knew I'd have to face my boss in the morning and explain what happened and what I'd been thinking when I made the choices I did. Had I thought everything through clearly? Was there something I missed? How was I to know? My thinking would be laid bare for everyone to see and judge. I walked into my boss's office the next day and explained what went through my mind. When I finished, I told him I wasn't ready for this job or the level of responsibility it required. He put his pen down, drew a deep breath, and said, "No one is ready for this job, Shane, but you and this team are all we got." His response wasn't exactly comforting. By team, he meant 12 people working 80 hours a week for years. By all we got, he meant starting the most important new program the agency had seen in generations. I walked away from our brief encounter with my head spinning. That night, I started asking myself questions that I continue exploring for the next decade. How can we get better at reasoning? Why do people make bad decisions? Why do some people consistently get better results than others who have the same information? How can I be right more often and decrease the probability of a bad outcome when lives are on the line? Up until that point in my career, I'd been fairly lucky. And while I wanted that luck to continue, I also wanted to depend on it less. If there was a method for clear thinking and good judgment, I wanted to harness it. If you're like me, no one ever taught you how to think or make decisions. There's no class called Clear Thinking 101 in school. Everyone seems to expect you to know how to do it already or to learn how on your own. As it turns out, though, learning about thinking clearly, is surprisingly hard.
Clear Thinking, Turning Ordinary Moments into Extraordinary Results by Shane Parrish is available from RNIB Talking Books, as read by the author with Will Damron. And once again, Lucy Edwards, thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
That's all we've got time for on today's show. We'll be back at the same time next week. But if you can't wait that long, this and over 400 other episodes of Read On are available to download as a podcast. Just search for RNIB Read On in your favourite podcast app. But remember our daily show, Talking Books, featuring the best the RNIB library has to offer, that we're allowed to play on here. That's every day at 2 p.m. or 10 p.m. if you prefer a book at bedtime. The whole schedule is at rnib.org.uk/connect-radio.
Books and accessible reading on RNIB Connect Radio.